Good morning and welcome to Shattering Mist. I'm your host and tour guide, Yada. Each weekday morning, I strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism and the media, with military and economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes may be opened and you may ultimately change your mind towards these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission this morning will be to help you understand what is occurring behind the headlines, all while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His one and only covenant and through His always dependable Torah teaching, so that with His guidance, you will be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship with Him. Our number, if you'd like to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said on this program, is 877-376-45. It is interesting as we listen to the news this morning and turn to Israel that the election there turned out to be somewhat similar to the elections that most recently took place in America. The Israeli leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, is likely to form a center-right coalition in the parliamentary system, but the election was much closer than had previously been anticipated. His Likud party won the most seats, particularly when you count the most recent Jewish Home Party votes, which are even more conservative, more entrenched, as it would you would view the Israeli claims to the land, claims which God supports, therefore I support, that collectively with them and with the ultra-conservative rabbinic parties, they have very close to a majority. But the liberal parties, one called There Is a Future, the other being the Labor Party that has long existed in Israel, collectively garnered an equivalent number of seats to Benjamin Netanyahu's and his Likud party and the Jewish Homeland Party combined. And so this will be a more difficult coalition for him to form. The media, of course, will spin this as a rebuke on Benjamin Netanyahu's conservative policies relative to expanding and building settlements in what the world refers to as the West Bank. The reality is that it isn't the West Bank. It is part of Israel. It's Judea and Samaria. And building homes is the single best thing you can do with the land. That was God's intent with the land. And those that want the land have no legitimate claim to it. They operate under a mythical name, Palestinians. They use a mythical name for the land and call it by the erroneous name Palestine. The world, ignorant of evidence, clamors to their support, buying into this myth. And yet to reward them with a state would be to reward terrorism, because that is the only tactic that they have used in their desire to confiscate the land. And ultimately, they have no interest whatsoever of living side by side with Israel in peace. If they did, then Egypt would not have attacked Israel multiple times. Syria would not have done so. Jordan would not have done so. The reason that these Islamic countries have collectively attacked Israel, the reason that their rhetoric today is violent jihad towards Israel, is because they have no intent of ever tolerating a Jewish state. Their goal is to kill every Jew and to conquer Israel, claiming it for Islam. There will never be a two-state solution there. And so Benjamin Netanyahu's decision to support the building of homes, particularly in Jerusalem, is a wise one. It is consistent with Yah's Torah. The reason that this election was closer than the previous one had nothing to do with the settlements and Benjamin Netanyahu. It had all to do with the same liberal mindset, the same socialist mindset, the same bankrupt mindset, grotesquely ignorant and immoral mindset that drove the elections most recently in the United States. It is the mindset that says we should take from those who have earned money and give to those who covet it. It is the mindset that we should spend beyond our means and pass the bill on to our children in economic pedophilia. It's the mindset that we should be dependent upon our government. Our government should be taking care of us. All of these mindsets are opposed to Yah's instructions. But it was social issues. And the desire by a growing percentage of the Israeli population to say, I want what is yours. I'm going to take it from you. I'm going to vote for you to give it to me. I understand that David Rubin has called in. I asked David, who was with us last week, to rejoin us today. David obviously can give a much clearer presentation of the most recent results in the Israeli elections. But the main reason that I asked David to join us today is because it is essential that the world understands the validity of the claim that Jews have to the land of Israel. The very fact is that not only did God give it to them, the history is exclusively in the favor of the Jewish people. But before David begins, I do want to provide a perspective on the Torah and on the prophets and Psalms. Collectively, these writings, which provide the initial authorization, the initial justification for the Jewish claims to Israel, that these are the ancient world's most accurate presentations of history. But more than this, this collection is filled with prophetic predictions, all of which have either come true precisely as they were written, or their fulfillment is being manifest before our very eyes. And as a result of these thousands of prophetic predictions, there is no other rational conclusion that can be drawn than this collection, the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, was inspired by God, and it is the only candidate in our world today for divine writ. And as a result of that, since it is obvious that it is true, that it was inspired by God, the centerpiece of the Torah is the covenant. And the covenant is inseparable from the land. And with that background, I'd like to reintroduce David Rubin. David is the author of a new book called The Islamic Tsunami, Israel and America in the Age of Obama. He has also written another book based upon the history of the land called God, Israel, and Shiloh, Returning to the Land. He is the founder of the Shiloh Israel Children's Organization. It's called the Shiloh Israel Children's Fund that he founded after he and his child were injured by Islamic terrorists. And he, born in New York, now resides in Shiloh, Israel, has been the mayor of Shiloh. So without further ado, David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be back with you.
First, why don't you give us just a quick recap on the narrower margin of victory for not only for Likud, but for Benjamin Netanyahu, and your assessment on the ability that he will have to form a center-right government that will still be protective of not only the those like you who live in Judea and Samaria, but also unwilling to simply hand over large swaths of land for promises of peace to appease the so-called Palestinians.
Well, it's not so clear what's going to be. But I can make my predictions. I've just written an article that was posted on JerusalemPost.com as well as IsraelNationalNews.com, which I call the Lapid Factor, because the candidate whose political party won the second largest amount of votes and with whom Netanyahu is going to be most likely to form a coalition, that is Yair Lapid. And the result of the elections shows that Lapid is going to have a lot of power in this new Israeli government. Netanyahu has 31 out of 120 seats in the Knesset, in the Israeli parliament. Lapid has 19 seats out of 120. Which brings the two of them up to about 50 seats, and that's not even a majority. So they're going to have to form a coalition with a couple of other individual parties, and that is the big question to me, because Lapid is a centrist party. Yesh Atid is the name of the party.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lapid's party is a centrist party, and very similar to Netanyahu's party.
Mm-hmm.
Which has centrist policies, where they try to protect the land of Israel, but they are willing to, or at least have expressed the willingness to create a Palestinian state, meaning a Muslim, Arab Muslim state in the heartland of Israel, in the biblical heartland of Israel, I might add.
Yes.
But they haven't done it up to this point because, those same so-called Palestinians have been refusing to even sit with the Israeli prime minister. So it's going to be interesting for sure. What is really interesting to me is whether Netanyahu will be forming the remainder of his coalition that will bring him to a majority of the Knesset, of the Israeli parliament, whether he'll be doing it with the right wing.
David, we'll have to pause a moment. We have a commercial break. We'll be back to Shattering Myths after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yada. We're here with David Rubin, who is the author of a new book on the really dire situation that we face in the world at large, but particularly faced in Israel. It's called the Islamic Tsunami. David was presenting really the muddled situation that now exists politically in Israel, with the most recent elections bringing very different results than the elections, the previous elections. David, one of the challenges has been that previously Netanyahu and Likud have formed a coalition with the Shas party, which is the ultra-conservative, the orthodox, if you will, religious party in Israel. But was not a lot of the voter change and overall resentment of the fact that they are exempt from military service and they live on a state welfare system, and that there was some pushback by the particularly middle class voters that want to see an end to the treatment of the Shah's religious party in terms of state subsidies to them, as well as their exemption from participating in the Israeli IDF? David? Okay. All right. We have temporarily lost David. David, are you back with us? Okay. What I just said is that there appears to have been an unusual set of circumstances in Israel where previously Likud has formed their coalition also by getting the Shah's religious party to join in support of that coalition. But the unique thing in this particular election is that a significant percentage of voters voted in rebuke of the subsidies that had been provided to the Shahs, the ultra-Orthodox religious Jews in Israel, and against their exemption from service in the IDF. And so bringing in a new coalition party, even though that party is similar in terms of its centrist perspective, you're not going to be able to do so with the in a coalition with the Shahs, because the one of their central platforms was in opposition to the Shahs.
Well, there are two different ways of looking at this. You have to understand, when the prime minister is forming a coalition, he doesn't have the luxury of saying, "Well, I don't want them because they have these particular views." Because if he's putting together a puzzle, and that's what I started to explain before, he's putting together a puzzle. Yesh Atid, the Yair Lapid's party, is going to be the easiest party for him to get into the coalition because the views are very similar to his. But then he's not going to have enough to complete the puzzle, and he has a choice. He can go with a political party like the Jewish Home Party, which is avowedly against creating a Palestinian state in the biblical heartland of Israel. That would get him up to a majority in the Knesset. And then he could just add on another one of the parties, and he wouldn't be as beholden to them. Another way that he can go is to bring in one of the left-wing secular parties. In which case, he would have to compromise a lot. He would have to agree to excessive Israeli concessions in terms of a Palestinian state. And that's something that I think he'd be hesitant to do. Obviously, he's expressed his openness to negotiate and all this, but he has not agreed to go back to 1967. Pre-Six-Day War borders, which were indefensible borders, often referred to as the borders of Auschwitz, referring to the notorious Nazi concentration camp. Obvious implication is that going back to those indefensible 1967 borders would imperil the country. So I don't think he wants to go with the left-wing secular parties. But the only other option is, yes, to go with the Jewish Home Party, which is avowedly against the Palestinian state, so it would involve some concession there. He would have to agree to continue with the building in the Jewish communities in Judea and Samaria, otherwise known as the West Bank. And if he does that, then he'll have a majority, but he would need to have a safe majority. He would need to add on one of the ultra-Orthodox parties, or ultimately bring in one of the left secular parties. And if he does that, then he's going to have some sort of concession, if not a big concession, in terms of negotiations with the Palestinians. So it's one way or the other. If he goes with the ultra-Orthodox, then he's going to have to agree to compromise to some extent on the issue of drafting the yeshiva students, the religious seminary boys. He would have to agree to compromise to some extent, meaning he'd probably have to say, okay, we'll make the change gradually. And I think that would be enough to get Shas into the coalition. I don't think he would have to give much more than that because Shas does want to go into the coalition.
All right, so we'll have to stay tuned. And when we return after the commercial break, we're going to talk about the... Okay, well, I've just been informed by Scott that we have skipped the commercial break at this time. So what we're going to do, David, is I would appreciate it if you could delineate the history of Israel. It's a subject that you have studied, you have written about, but going right from the beginning, from the original discussions between God and Abraham, and this connection between the covenant and the land, if you would walk us through the history of Israel, while why the Jewish people have a legitimate claim to the land, both from God and in terms of history, and why this notion of a Palestinian state and a Palestinian people is a myth, as well as the nature of the tactics that Muslims have used to try to claim the land for themselves and why those tactics should not be used. So it's a lot to cover, but I'd like you to begin, if you wouldn't mind, tell us the history of this place the world knows as Israel.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to give you a 3,500-year history in a matter of minutes. So I'm going to have to give you the highlights, and there may be some details that will be left out, but you're going to get the highlights. And I advise your listeners to listen very carefully, because if you miss something, then you may miss something very important. You may miss the important points here. Okay, I heard you before. I heard you describing the covenant of the people of Israel with the God of Israel, with God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, where when the Western world talks about God, generally they are speaking about what we refer to as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Who was Abraham? Who were Isaac? And who were Jacob? Those were the first Jews. There was the beginning of the Jewish people, the beginning of the people of Israel, and that beginning occurred in the land of Israel. After the Exodus from slavery in Egypt, the people who were descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob left slavery in Egypt and came into the land of Israel after wanderings in the desert. But something happened before we came into the land of Israel. We came to a place called Mount Sinai, where God gave the leader of Israel, Moses, the Ten Commandments, and the Torah of Israel, and the knowledge of God's law. And so we came down, Moses came down from Mount Sinai with the basics of Judaism, the basics of God's law, which was eventually adopted by Western civilization. And this understanding is what they brought into the land of Israel. Now, in the land of Israel, that covenant was renewed, and 14 years after the entry into the land and the conquering of Jericho, we came into a place called Shiloh, as Americans know it as Shiloh, of course. I often use the Hebrew term Shiloh, which is what we call it here. And the tabernacle of Israel was set up by the successor of Moses, a fellow by the name of Joshua. Joshua was the great leader of Israel. He established the tabernacle in Shiloh. It stood here for 369 years. This was the capital, and I should mention I'm speaking to you from Shiloh right now. And the capital of Israel was here for 369 years. There was a woman who came to Shiloh to pray for a son. Her name was Hannah. As a result of her prayers, the son was born, and the son's name was Samuel. Samuel was a prophet. He grew up into prophecy in Shiloh. And he was the one who would eventually merit to appoint the first two kings of Israel, Saul and David. And David was the one who set up the unified kingdom of Israel in Jerusalem with the Holy Temple in Jerusalem, which was built by his son Solomon. And that kingdom stood in Jerusalem for 440 years. Now, I want to remind your listeners that we're talking here about approximately 1,000 years that Israel was a sovereign nation in the land of Israel. The United States has not existed for even close to half of that amount of time. And no one would question the sovereignty of the United States. So Israel was the sovereign nation. Eventually, we were chased out of the land by the Romans and scattered around the world by the Roman conquerors. When the Romans conquered the land of Israel and expelled all of the Jews from, or most of the Jews from the land of Israel, and destroyed our sovereignty in the land of Israel, they did something else very interesting. They understood the importance of semantics, and they changed the name of the land of Israel from Israel and Judea to Palestina. Now, Palestina eventually evolved into Palestine, which was called for about 2,000 years by most people. And then even the Jews who grew up in the land of Israel called it Palestine. In fact, my father-in-law, who was born in the land of Israel in 1939, before the rise of the State of Israel, he referred to himself as a Palestinian.
Yeah, why did the Judean province as it was known in Rome, the province of Judea, become known as Palestina in 135 CE? What was the purpose of changing the name of the province? Why did the Romans do it?
It had a dual purpose. One purpose was to simply erase the name of its rightful possessors, to erase the names of Israel and Judea from the map, and to give it some foreign name. But it wasn't just a foreign name.
Yes.
It was a name that comes from the Roman derivative of the word Philistines,
correct,
who were the archenemies of Israel.
The name itself, though, was not pulled out of a hat. It wasn't just created by the Romans out of thin air.
What greater insult could there be than to rename a country after that country's worst enemy?
Yes, but one of the things that it does is that it gives legitimacy to the foundational document of Israel, because the name of these so-called Philistines is derived only from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Apart from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, nothing is known of the people called the Philistines. There are allegedly some references in Egypt, but the references in Egypt are to the sea people, and those are the Phoenicians. And so there is absolutely no historical reference of any kind apart from the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms of the Philistines. And so by naming the land Philistina, what the Romans indirectly did is address the legitimacy of the historical accounts as they're presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And the moment you do that, the moment you say, well, the rightful name of this place is Palestine, then what you're doing is you're saying that the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms present a true history of the relationship between God and the children of Israel, and as a result, the land belongs to the children of Israel, because Scripture is quite clear. The people known as the Philistines are all gone. They were wiped out over 2,500 years ago. There isn't any history of their culture or any people that can racially trace their roots back to the so-called Philistines.
Yep. Well, those are all good points. But I'd like to continue with the history, and we're pretty much getting close to the present. And I'd like you to remind me to make another point about that word Palestinians and Palestine, but I'll do that in a few minutes. So we're talking about the return to the land that began in the latter part of the 19th century when Israel started coming back to the land as a people, and eventually because they were creating an economy, recreating an economy in the land of Israel, which up to that point had been in barren land for about 2,000 years in fulfillment of prophecy. And now as Israel was coming back into the land, an economy was being created, and the land was giving of its fruit again, trees were being planted, and there was agriculture being created, and that, of course, also in fulfillment of prophecy. And in addition to that, a lot of Arabs started to move to the land of Israel because they found a way to get jobs. But there were other Arabs who were opposed to Israel even being there. And they started to attack and riot, and there were all kinds of riots and murders of Jews and terrorism on the roads. And all of this eventually developed into the War of Independence in 1948, Israel declared itself an independent state. And I should point out that in 1917, the British, who were given responsibility by the League of Nations over the land of Israel at that time, declared what they called the Balfour Declaration, which said that they would create a Jewish home. The Jewish homeland would be established in the land of what they called the Palestine Mandate, the British Mandate over what they were calling Palestine at that time.
Yeah, the British unfortunately did not honor that agreement.
Yep, but
and unfortunately part of the reason they didn't honor it is because of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem at that time, and that he had begun to use terrorism as the tactic to make it difficult for the British to honor that mandate, and so the British capitulated to the terror that was being perpetrated by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who was the primary Islamic leader at the time, rewarding terrorism, setting the pattern that is used today by the world rewarding terrorism. To try to stop terrorism, the world rewards the terrorists, appeases
them.
That's
right, absolutely correct, So as a result of that, and by the way, even the Mufti didn't call himself a Palestinian.
No.
He refused to use the term Palestinians. He said, we're part of the greater Arab nation. And that was their stand. There was no Palestinian people at that time. And as I said, anyone who referred to himself as a Palestinian was probably a Jew. So what happened was in 1948, after the British had already split off 78% of the British mandate and handed it over to King Abdullah from Saudi Arabia. He came down from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, and they gave him 78% of the eastern side, the east bank of the Jordan River, so to speak. And that was 78% of the British mandate. So Israel was left with 22% of the British mandate, and that is where the state of Israel was partially established. All the Arab countries went to war against Israel, and the heartland of Israel, the biblical heartland of Israel, where all the biblical places are located, Judea and Samaria, and also eastern Jerusalem, all of that was taken by the Kingdom of Jordan from Israel, and the Gaza Strip was taken by Egypt, the Golan Heights were taken by Syria, and Israel was left a truncated state, which had remained from 1948 to 1967. In 1967, the Six-Day War, Israel was attacked from all sides, and it recaptured those lands, Judea, Samaria, the biblical heartland of Israel, with Bethlehem, with with Shiloh, with Shem, with Jericho. All of these places came back into Israel's hands, as did Gaza and the Sinai Desert and the Golan Heights. And
as a matter of fact, if Israel hadn't been stopped by the United States, it would have seized Damascus and seized Cairo at that time. So the Muslims made a tremendous miscalculation in trying to destroy Israel militarily, even though they outgunned Israel 100-1. Israel not only prevailed, but had the United States not interceded and stopped Israel, it would have conquered both Cairo and Damascus and controlled a huge swath of what is now the Islamic Middle East.
Not only did we prevail, but we prevailed in 6 days, and on the seventh day we rested, because the seventh day was the Jewish Sabbath. So this is not a normal people we're talking about. I admit that. We're talking about a people that has a special relationship with God and the teachings of God for civilization. So anyhow, jumping ahead, 1993, the Oslo Accords were signed. I forgot.
You're going to skip the Yom Kippur? Yes, well, Yom Kippur War?
Yeah, I could talk about the Yom Kippur War when Israel was attacked again on all sides by the Arab world.
Let's call it the Muslim world.
Thank God at that time we managed to keep control of the land of Israel that was in our hands up to that point.
David, I'm going to have you stop there for a moment. We'll continue with this story on the other side of the break. We're with David Rubin, the author of The Islamic Tsunami, calling in from Shiloh or Shiloh, depending on your preferred pronunciation of the town. And we will continue to hear his presentation of the state of Israel in a moment. To Shattering Mist. I'm your host, Yada. We have as our guest today a man named David Rubin. He is calling in from Shiloh. The Shin Yod Lamed He is the way that it is written in Hebrew. And so the vowel sound would come from the Yod, the first letter in God's name. He is presenting a history of the land and has taken us all the way up to the point of the Yom Kippurim War, where Muslims decided that they could prevail with a sneak attack on Israel. Lost. And the most amazing part of that story, of course, is what happened on the Golan Heights with the Syrians having such an advantage, both in technology and numbers, in the tank battle that began that war. And yet, God's not about to allow his people to be ejected from the land now that he has brought them back. So please continue the story, David.
Okay, so I'm not going to be able to get into all the details of the Yom Kippur War because I know that we only have a few minutes and I want to get up to the present. So I'll just tell you that yes, Israel did prevail in the Yom Kippur War, but I also didn't mention that in 1964 an organization was started called the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the people that had never existed and that had never chose to adopt the Roman term Palestine, suddenly realized, hey, this is a way to destroy Israel. Let's create a people. Yeah. We'll call it the indigenous people of the land of Israel. We won't call it the land of Israel, but the
Palestine.
Palestine, they say. Right. It's always been called Palestine. We'll say ridiculous things like Jesus was a Palestinian, even though he was born way before the Romans drove the Jews out of Israel. And
his name wasn't Jesus. Besides, his name wasn't Jesus. Okay, we'll deal with that in the second hour.
But the fact is that that this new people that was created was used as a tool to destroy Israel. And that was the only purpose, the only reason why this people was invented.
Correct.
And so then jumping ahead to, to the succeeding years, 1993, the Oslo Accords are signed. A left-wing government in Israel foolishly agreed to establish a process that could lead towards a Palestinian state in the biblical heartland of Israel.
Yeah, Palestinian Authority was created. Government control. All of a sudden, they were receiving enormous amounts of money from not only the Islamic world, but from the West.
They were legitimized.
Yes, correct.
So what happened?
By the way, that was a terrorist organization, the PLO. You know, the perpetrators.
Not just one. There were other terrorist organizations that weren't even a part of the PLO, like the Hamas, like the Islamic Jihad. And so, the PLO was mainly the Fatah terrorist organization. They all joined together.
They're inseparable. Fatah and the PLO are one and the same.
That's right. And that is Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, his successor, who's the current head of the Palestinian Authority. And now I just want to point out that despite all of the terrorism, let's just put the terrorism to the side for a moment. And obviously the terrorism delegitimizes them as any moral factor in the
right.
of Israel. But just putting that aside for a moment, this is an invented people. They have never been a people. They have never been a sovereign nation in the Middle East. And certainly the terrorism and the way they act delegitimizes their right to any sovereign nation. But they don't have a right. It's not their land. And when we talk about the Palestinians, there's another meaning for the word Palestine. The word Palestine comes from, there's also a root. If you look at the root, every Hebrew word has roots.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say the word Palestine in Hebrew, Palestine, it is spelt with the Hebrew letters Pe Lamed Shin, which means Palash, which means to invade and take something that doesn't belong to you.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Inadvertently, they gave it a name, saying that they're robbers and thieves.
David, thank you for sharing that, and particularly your last insight. I love the fact that God named everything in a way that teaches us what he was trying to convey. We'll return to Shattering Myths after the break.
A little over a year ago, I began to do a lot of research into why, even though I had a pretty good-sized meal, that I was still starving. And my research led me to a well-known fact that...